Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this, the latest in the OAS podcast series. This is the seventh podcast that we're doing on the impact on the energy markets of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. And we're recording this podcast at 10:00 hours London time on Friday, the 20th of May, 2022. And it's my great pleasure to be joined today by Mike Ford, who's Senior Research Fellow, and Jack Sharples, who's Research Fellow at the Institute. And we're here to discuss the gas markets and what's been going on over the last 10 days in Europe since the last Russia-Ukraine update. Now, Jack, let's start with you, if I may. In the last podcast, we talked about EU and the UK LNG imports and send-outs. Can you perhaps give us an update on what's been going on?
Well, since our last podcast, EU and UK LNG, both imports and send-out from the terminals, has declined ever so slightly, but they remain very strong. So in May to date, the daily average LNG imports are in fact slightly higher than the April daily average, but the send out is slightly lower. So more LNG is coming in, but we're slowly accumulating some stocks at LNG terminals. So Europe now has about 4.1 BCM in storage at its LNG terminals, which represents about 70% of the storage capacity at those terminals. And as we've discussed in previous podcasts, given that the terminals need storage capacity to accept cargoes, as both you and Mike have discussed previously, that's not far off their full working capacity, let's say.
Okay, so Mike, why did it come to you to carry on the discussion on the LNG theme? You know, can you give us an outlook on the LNG for the rest of 2022? I expect the question for our listeners really is, are we going to continue to see Europe hoovering up the supply of LNG that we've really seen in the first 4 months of 2022? What are your views on that?
Yeah, I think, thank you, Dave. I think it's so far so good is a summary. We've obviously had a lot of LNG coming to Europe, as Jack has noted. I mean, Europe as a whole, including Turkey, is first 4 months about 20 billion cubic metres higher than the 2021. So it's basically hoovered up all the increased supply and more, as we've seen diversions away from the Asian markets and Central South America. In terms of May numbers, it seems to be pretty much a continuation of that trend. So May is going to be much higher than May last year. China seems to have bounced back a little bit from April, but still well below last year's levels because of the obviously lockdowns they're having there, and industrial output's thought to be down in China. So, but the other Asian markets, a little bit of a pickup in Japan, but the Southeast Asian ones are roaring ahead, they're growing quite strongly. So, and also Argentina has started to import quite a bit more. So there's a few changes sort of going on. And I think through the summer, sort of through to about August time, then imports of LNG into Europe were quite low last year. So I think we will see significant year-on-year increases, especially if Russian flows, and, you know, even if they maintain the sort of current levels, we'll see that. But come August, September time, I think that's when we might see the Asian buyers back into the market. It's already reported that China has been looking at spot cargoes from August onwards. And there's talk about a stimulus package as they come out of lockdown, which is likely to increase demand. So I think the possibility of Europe continuing to get a lot more LNG, hoovering it up, as you say, is fine for the next few months. But as we enter the back 4 or 5 months of the year, I think things will get significantly tighter as demand sort of returns to the Asian end of the market. So, you know, I think then we could see some sort of impact on prices if that's true.
Hence the importance, of course, of having storage in Europe, gas storage in Europe, as full as it can before we enter that period. And of course, Jack, we'll come to that discussion later in this podcast. But before we do that, can I come to you, Jack, and move the discussion on to pipeline supply? And why don't we start with non-Russian gas supply on this podcast? Can you perhaps, Jack, give us an update on that?
The pipeline flows from North Africa remained strong in the first half of May up until the 16th at around 95 to 100 million cubic metres per day, but then fell sharply to around 80 million cubic metres per day on the 17th and 18th of May. Now, obviously, we need to wait and see if this is a temporary blip or a more permanent stepping down. For those who are maybe not so familiar with the geography of those North African supplies, part of it goes from Algeria to Spain, and then part of it goes from Algeria to Italy, in addition to a smaller volume of Libyan pipeline gas also to Italy. But Algeria is the main player there. Now, if we head north, the daily average flows from Norway to the EU and the UK in the first 18 days of May were around 325 million cubic meters per day. So again, that's, you know, three and a half times what we're getting from North Africa, and exactly the same as the daily average for April. Flows from Norway to the EU, that is to France, Belgium, the Netherlands and Germany, remain at their full capacity. Those pipelines are being used to their maximum, while flows to the UK on the Langeled pipeline have recovered from their late April slump to around two-thirds of the pipeline capacity. So this is part of, let's say, the UK remaining flooded with gas, as per indeed our very own Mike Fullwood's latest extensive interview with Sky News. Now, the flows from Azerbaijan on the Turkey-Greece border are also still at pretty close to full capacity, about 30 million cubic meters per day. So that gives you a bit of an overview, really, of the three main non-Russian pipeline supplies.
Indeed, I think it's fair to say for our listeners that both of you have been interviewed by the press extensively since the 24th of February. So, you know, thank you very much for that. But Jack, why don't I stay with you? Can we perhaps now talk about Russian flows into Europe? You know, where are we on that subject?
Well, if we exclude Russian flows to Turkey, because we don't have the granular daily data for that, but all the other Russian flows to Europe, so that's continental Europe, it's Finland and the Baltic states, in the first 18 days of May, they averaged about 280 million cubic meters per day, which is exactly the same as the April daily average. Now, while the Nord Stream pipeline remains at its full capacity and the Turkish Stream pipeline is at about two-thirds of its capacity, which reflects some of the end of winter drop in demand in Southeast Europe, we have seen some other more significant fluctuations on the Ukrainian route, which we can discuss in more detail.
Okay, but just moving kind of the impact of sanctions for a minute, because you know, May the 11th did see some sanctions kick in and Russian gas flows into Ukraine halted. Can you perhaps share more details of that with our listeners?
To, you know, to dig into this fluctuation, if you like, in supplies on the Ukrainian route, on the 11th of May, the Russian government issued some sanctions against Gazprom's former subsidiaries. Let's recall that from the 1st of April, Gazprom effectively disowned some of its trading subsidiaries in Europe, namely Gazprom Germania and all of its subsidiaries, including Gazprom Marketing and Trading and Vingas. But the Russian government also issued sanctions against Europol Gas, which is a consortium effectively in which Gazprom held a 49% stake to manage the Yamal-Europe pipeline via Poland from Belarus to Germany. Now, because Gazprom's subsidiaries are no longer receiving gas from Gazprom and Gazprom is no longer using the Yamal-Europe pipeline, which was already at zero in any case, but the sanctions mean that it's pretty well certain that the flows won't restart on that route, then that has caused some of this fluctuation in supply. Now, coincidentally, on the same day, flows of Russian gas into Ukraine at the Sokhranivka cross-border interconnection halted, and flows at the larger Sudsha interconnection also declined in the days that followed. So let's recall that when Russian gas is delivered to Europe via Ukraine, Sudsha and Sokhranivka are the two points at which Russian gas enters Ukraine. Now, the flows, let's say, go back to March, when Russian flows had risen in the aftermath of the invasion. Probably we were seeing about 35 million cubic meters per day flowing from Russia to Ukraine at Sokhranivka and about 75 million cubic meters per day at Sudsha. So Sudsha is very much the larger of these two. Now, Sokhranivka situation is linked to the Ukrainian TSO, GTSOU, announcing that it no longer has control over the metering station or indeed the compressor station in the area. Now, the overall drop in flows, therefore, is sort of linked to both of these elements, let's say. So how this has affected Russian flows to Europe in recent days, we've seen it drop from around 280 million cubic meters per day on the 10th of May to around 250 million cubic meters per day 48 hours later. So clearly this is having an impact.
Thanks, Jack, very much indeed. Mike, can I come to you? Because, of course, an overarching issue on the whole kind of Russia's situation with Ukraine is the insistence by Russia that payments for gas be made in rubles. So could you give us an update on what we're calling the rubles payment issue?
Yes, I'll try to. It's a little bit confusing, to say the least. I mean, just one factual point. The Gazprom, the Finnish company, said they wouldn't pay in rubles and has launched arbitration proceedings, and they do expect to be cut off.
That's Gazprom, just to become clear.
Gazprom in Finland, yeah. Yeah, but in terms of, I guess, still the advice coming out of the EU, I mean, they seem to be saying that, yes, you could open the accounts at Gazprom Bank, and providing you make the payment in euros, and then say that absolves me of my liability. I paid you, and the transaction can kind of go through. I'm not sure that fits with what Putin's decree said, but that's kind of fairly vague. And then an EU spokesman probably popped up 2 hours later and said, if you open a ruble account, that's breaching sanctions. And then something else came out a day later saying it was almost like, well, do what you want as long as you don't breach sanctions. So it's sort of a very, very confusing situation. I think a Russia minister, deputy minister, quoted that the 54 entities who have relationships with Gazprom, some half had opened the requisite accounts, and I assume that meant euro and ruble accounts, and others were doing so. It does look as though all the big players, especially in Germany, Italy, have opened the requisite accounts. And sort of today and or the latter half of this week and next week is when the payments are probably going to be all made for the April gas, that is. So I think it's a little bit to wait and see as to who else other than Poland and Bulgaria, who have been cut off a week or two ago, might get cut off. Obviously, the Baltic states have said they're not going to take any more Russian gas. And then promptly more Russian gas turned up at one of the countries and went in. So it is all a little bit confusing. But I think by this time next week, we're going to have a much clearer picture as to sort of what is happening there.
And of course, you know, we will be reporting on that both in, of course, written form and also in our podcasts in the future. Well, look, Jack, can I come back to you, if I may? Because I'd like to move the discussion to talk about gas storage, as I said I would earlier in the podcast. You know, what is the status of storage in Europe relative to targets and last year?
Well, let's recall that the European Commission target is for Europe to have storage at 80% full by the 1st of November, and then from next year to be 90% full by the 1st of October every year. So clearly the longer term aim is to make sure that we have plenty in storage at the beginning of each winter. Now, actually, that target of 80 BCM approximately in storage by the 1st of November is pretty much identical to the situation that we found ourselves in at the start of last winter. So on the 1st of November 2021, we had about 80 BCM in storage. So where we are today, so the latest data that I've seen, the 17th of May, showed that Europe has stocks of around 42.1 BCM. Now, that is 7 BCM higher year on year. Part of that is because the winter in Q1 of 2022 was significantly milder than in the first quarter of 2021, not only here in Europe, but also in Northeast Asia. So let's recall, in the first quarter of 2021, we saw significant diversions of LNG cargoes away from Europe to the Northeast Asian market to help them cope with their cold spell. And here in Europe, we drew heavily on storage to effectively balance the market. Now, the reverse has been true in the first several months of 2022, where it's been relatively mild. We haven't drawn as much out of storage, and in fact, we have been attracting record LNG imports. So we're 7 BCM better off year on year. Part of this is also because the stock build since the 1st of April has been much faster than last year. Last year, in April, we had pretty much flat storage injections. So we put a bit in storage, we took a bit out of storage, we put a bit back in. And between the 1st of April and the 1st of May, actual storage stocks didn't really shift at all. Whereas this year, we've seen good, strong injections in April. And in fact, the stock build since the 1st of April up to the 17th of May of 15 BCM is a new record. It's even 0.3 BCM higher than the COVID-afflicted 2020, when storage absorbed excess supply when demand dropped during the first wave of lockdowns. Now, theoretically, therefore, we are very much on course to achieve that Commission target of 80 BCM in storage by the 1st of November. But I would caution that this cannot be achieved without Russian pipeline supply, at least continuing, as Mike says, at take or pay levels. However, as we've discussed in this podcast and at length elsewhere, that supply does remain a little bit uncertain, partly because of the ruble payment issue, physical supplies via Ukraine, various uncertainties. So it's heavily caveated, let's say.
Yeah, I think maybe you could be the king of the understatement there when you say, you know, partly. But anyway, well, look, Mike, why don't I ask you to kind of close off this podcast? Because I'd like to talk for a few minutes about the latest EU documents, RePower EU, which have been published. Now, can you perhaps share your initial thoughts on this, and especially the short-term responses, which maybe includes the possibility of a price cap? Now, have you had time to look at these, and have you got any comments?
Yes, I mean, I think I've had time to look at the documents we could download, the one we couldn't sort of get hold of. I mean, Jack may have some thoughts on this as well, if he's had a chance to review it as well as you, David. But I think, yes, there's a whole suite of documents came out. One, mainly on the Repower EU, and the staff working document had a lot of detail on that. That's more medium to long term. But also documents on short-term energy market responses, which is also issued by DG Energy, Kadri Simpson. So there's a focus mainly on the short-term stuff, as a lot of the repass is more longer-term. A few things sort of rising out of that before we come on to the price cap possibility. Firstly, there's this idea of reducing Russian imports by two-thirds by the end of the year. That seems to be omitted from any document at all now. They're talking about replacing some Russian imports by increasing LNG. They use the 50 BCM number again, another 10 BCM from pipeline imports, and then 10 BCM from turning down your thermostat, basically, in the winter. So that amounts to 70 BCM. So that's the number they're sort of looking at. Obviously, the turning down the thermostat doesn't really occur until October. You know, I've turned my heating off, but then we're very hardy north of Watford, so I don't know what other people have. But the 50 BCM, I mean, as I was saying, the LNG, we're probably going to get to about 35, 40 BCM increase anyway, so it's not too much of a stretch to get to 50 if there's enough regas capacity to take it into the sort of affected market. So That two-thirds reduction seems to have gone away. Now, obviously, longer term, they're talking about those sorts of reductions. The next thing is, in the short term, they're talking a lot about what happens if there's a disruption of Russian supplies. Sort of carefully reading between the lines, I think the idea of the EU sanctioning Russian gas and stopping the flows, maybe it's me being optimistic, that seems to have be going away a little bit. All the talk now is off if Russia curtails supplies, what would we do? So maybe I'm misreading it, but I think that's the sense I kind of got from reading between the lines. And there's obviously a lot of discussion about the, you know, what you do in terms of if there's a curtailment, you would need to ration demand and how you might do that. Talks of the solidarity mechanism amongst the EU countries, EU member states. However, the impact would be really felt by sort of a handful of countries in northwestern central Europe, clearly Germany, potentially Denmark if their production's down, Austria, Czech Republic, Slovakia, some to Italy and Slovenia, sort of around those swathe of countries, maybe Netherlands a little bit, but, you know, sort of France, Spain and Portugal. You know, there's not a lot of point in asking France to turn down demands, because they can't really shift that much gas eastwards to help the others out. So the solidarity mechanism would have to be a limited amount of countries. Now, clearly, obviously, as we've seen, you can use the UK as a land bridge to import LNG. But, you know, it's obviously been reported the interconnectors basically full exporting. We can't get any more gas in there. We're even burning gas in our power stations and re-exporting electricity to France, of all places. So there are limitations there. So moving on to the price cap or possibility, it's sort of mentioned in a number of places in the documents. There's talk about retail price regulation, which obviously some countries do anyway, so I don't think that's particularly difficult to do, but it's advisable, that's the matter. And then there's a mention of an administrative price cap in a document, and then capping prices on the hub exchanges. I think all these are fairly kind of fraught, even if they're advisable, which I'm not sure they are, they're kind of fraught with difficulties. Hubs are unregulated markets. Now, the exchanges, you may regulate the process they go through in terms of financial regulation, but you do not regulate the price. So you'd have to pass legislation to do that. And if the idea of a price cap is to have an immediate impact in the case of disruption, I mean, you're not able to do that because you can't cap the price. Even if you could cap the price on the exchanges, then what do you do on the over-the-counter market? It's kind of very difficult there. Jack, do you want to add anything there? I've got a couple other points to make, but you jump in there.
Yeah, sure. I would add something on the physical flow. I mean, you mentioned that the target of reducing imports of Russian gas by 2/3 has sort of quietly slipped off the agenda, seemingly. I would just add a sort of a physical flow perspective. In 2021, Europe received about 142 BCM of pipeline gas from Russia. So if you want to reduce that by 2/3 year on year, let's say, you know, let's call it ballpark 45 to 50 BCM is what you'd be limited to importing in this calendar year if you wanted to achieve that. But actually, we've already imported 39 BCM of Russian gas in the year to date. So if you want to achieve that target of reducing pipeline imports from Russia by 2/3, then within the next 6 weeks, you're going to have to stop taking Russian gas entirely for the rest of the year, which is something that we obviously hope doesn't happen. I think it is notable that the pipeline import of Russian gas into Europe has declined by about 32% year on year, which is about an 18 BCM drop from about 57.8 down to 39.6 BCM. So Russian pipeline supplies to Europe have declined, but I think that the target of reducing that by 2/3 this year is, absent any dramatic cutoff, let's say, does not look very realistic.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, Jack. I mean, you'd have to curtail them completely to reach the target, which is why I think it's slipped quietly off the agenda, as you said. But return to sort of the price cap issue. I mean, even if you could legislate for it then and actually implement that on exchanges, there is a whole host of other issues. I mean, obviously, a lot of the Gazprom contracts are effectively hub price linked now. So if you've interfered in the market, you know, what happens to the price of those contracts? And then there's a whole swathe of forward deals being done, both on exchanges, over the counter, futures. How do you unravel all those? Because there's, for everyone who's bought gas or sold gas at a high level, there's somebody who's bought it as well on under all these deals. So if you interfered in the market, then how do you actually assess the price that needs to be done under these deals? And as soon as you've, you may be able to unravel a few of them, but the claim force majeure, but then the whole house of cards completely falls apart. And there's billions, if not trillions, of euros involved in these contracts, you know, looking forward. And if all that unravels, I mean, there's, think of the litigation, but, or potential bankruptcies in lots of companies, not just in Europe, but possibly worldwide. I mean, barely bears thinking about what might happen if you sort of interfered in that sort of market. So I think to be fair to the EU documents, they do talk about issues surrounding this, whether it's, you know, it's not sending the right price signals or how you would do it. But it's obviously raised as a possibility. But I think just the difficulties of implementation and the effects it would have on the market. Plus, if you did decide to somehow cap the wholesale price, then you might make the matters worse, because less LNG would sort of turn up in the market. So I think there's a lot of discussion to have on this as we go forward. But again, while raising it as a possibility, I think its prospect is also possibly receding because of the sheer difficulties of doing it.
And I think that's a kind of brings a sense of realism to the debate which we've been having over the last 25 minutes here. You know, it is a complex situation, and it's that kind of balance between regulation and the market which is going to, I think, challenge many people in the industry over the coming months and years. Well, look, you know, thank you both again so much for your contribution. I have to say, you know, I thought maybe we were going to have a quiet podcast when we wouldn't have much to report, but, you know, you certainly identified I was completely wrong with that, and there's still an awful lot going on. So, you know, please do go to the OIS website to see our recent research from Jack and Mike, as indeed, as well as from all our other researchers and our programmes. So thank you very much indeed for listening to this podcast. Take care to yourselves and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.